water before it got to the beach.
So you think it's better to send it throughout the water column than to send it to the beach?
I don't know. I have to say, I'm not an expert in that area.
Well, I'm not convinced.
And that's a very good question. That's a question that can be argued both ways, and I don't know the answer to it. In this case, the idea, you know, we thought about using dispersants. We tested using dispersants. We never used dispersants in large quantity because I don't think there exists a large enough quantity to have stopped the forward motion of that wall of oil. There was 240,000 barrels of oil out there. I have never seen that much oil in my life before, and I've been doing this for 15 years. That is a tremendous amount of oil. And at the rate it came out of the ship, like I said, I had one of my people, and Dan Horn from ABEC in Valdez was on board that ship by 3:30. And to paraphrase what they said, the oil was boiling out of the side of the ship from all the holes on the starboard side. And was basically the oil pouring out was like 3 or 4 foot higher than the seawater outside. I mean, there must have been close to 200,000 barrels of oil released from that ship within 3 hours. And it's your worst nightmare. From a response mode, it's very, very frustrating. Very, very, you feel totally useless. And it's very difficult, is all I can say.
Don Carnett would like to follow up on that particular statement, if you will.
On the subject of dispersants, you tend to forget, people tend to forget, that oil is biodegradable. If don't kid yourself, go down to the Santa Barbara Channel. There are natural seeps in the Santa Barbara Channel that put out thousands of barrels a day. Nobody cleans that up. Excuse me. Do you have a speech you want to make? I've spent 4.5 years in the Santa Barbara Channel. It's a place that people drive all the way across the country to spend time. It's a beautiful place, but it has natural oil seeps throughout it, and nobody cleans them up, nobody disperses them. When oil goes into water, two things happen immediately. Part of it evaporates, part of it dissolves in the ocean, and there are natural seeps all around this country. Oil in the water is a phenomenon that has gone on for eons.
And it stinks and kills everything.
Okay.
Forgot about that.
I'm doing my best here to keep a train of thought. If I'm trying to be helpful. If you don't want this information, I'll sit back down. But I have spent a lot of time in this area, and the gentleman seemed to be, or the lady seemed to be interested in the state of the art of this person. When we first started having oil spills, Santa Barbara, Tampa Bay, the Torrey Canyon, everybody, the first thing they did was run out with straw. And then they ended up for months picking up straw and oil, and they didn't know what to do with it. And somebody came up with the idea putting detergent on it, like Tide. And then they came up with some more detergents that were a little stronger. We made some bad mistakes in the beginning. I remember a spill in Tampa Bay in 1970 or 71. A tanker came into Tampa Bay with heavy fuel oil, scraped it, ground it very much like this one did, filled the Tampa Bay with black fuel oil. We thought dispersants were the answer. We went in and it was very early in the stage. They'd roll drums of dispersant up on the beach and knock the head in, and it'd run into the... We bleached Tampa Bay, killed everything in sight out of ignorance. Tampa Bay today doesn't show the effects of that. But as a result of those mistakes, the EPA banned dispersants. And we went into the laboratory, and a lot of other people went into their laboratories, and we developed dispersants that are mild. It took us 15 years to get EPA to say, this is a good way to treat an oil spill now with these new modern-day dispersants. What they do, and back to the point of biodegradability, what they do is enhance the biodegradability. They break the surface tension of the oil, allow it to become very small droplets. It increases the solution in the water. It does not sink the oil. It increases the solution in the water in the first few few inches on the top of the water. It increases the volatility, but it makes a much larger surface area to allow the bugs to operate on it, the bacteria. The same thing that cleans up Santa Barbara Channel day in and day out. That is why we believe dispersants are a good thing to do. They keep the oil off the birds then because it doesn't stick to them, it doesn't stick to the sea otters. We have demonstrated the safety of dispersants on many, many species, grass shrimp, baby salmon, you name it. If we thought dumping this stuff in Prince William Sound would damage the fishery, not only would we not do it, but the EPA wouldn't allow it, the Coast Guard wouldn't allow it, and Denny Kelso wouldn't allow it, and all those guys agreed to do it. A little bit late, but they agreed to do it. So dispersants, let me tell you, that is on a spill, like in the contingency plan for this facility, the response plan for a catastrophic spill is primarily catch it early and spray it. Because you can see the kind of job we have on our hands now to take that oil out of the water with skimmers, and the first time you get 73 mile an hour winds, it goes south about 30 miles a night, and it ends up on the shore, and that's where it is, that's where it's going to be, and that's where we're going to be for about the next 3 months with sorbent pads and toothbrushes and cleaning, and we'll have 1,000 people probably working on this before we're through with it, because we did not use dispersants as we should have and as the pre-approved plan allowed. Now that's on dispersants. If I could, I've heard three or four questions about closing down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Beg your pardon?
To those, rather than use this as a forum and another press conference. We've heard you speak a lot. We would like you to answer questions from the floor shortly and succinctly, if you would, please.
The question was raised about the operation of the Alyeska pipeline, and I think we should answer that one as well. Go ahead, Mr. Cornett.
I don't think that is an option. Think about it. It is the backbone. It is the back.
Please don't interrupt. Let's listen to the speaker.
It is just not an option. The Trans-Alaska pipeline has to operate. One out of every four barrels of oil that is produced in this country comes down that pipeline. And for that pipeline to operate, those tankers have to operate. We have demonstrated the low probability of this accident happening. You have it before your own eyes. We have drained more than half of the largest field in this country before this happened. This is a very low probability event. Unfortunately, it happened, and we are taking the responsibility for it. But the idea of shutting down that port is just not worth discussing. It is not going to happen.
Guys, let me just bring you up to speed on something, okay? One is that we are making some decisions which are more political and good for our resources. We can't afford to be obstructionists. We have to let these guys hang themselves. Now, I'm serious about this. Some of what he said about dispersants was correct. However, the dispersants, if you think about it, also take the oil off the birds. I mean, the natural oil, okay? These dispersants are not the miracle cure, and they do increase the toxicity of the dispersed oil. However, we can't afford to be obstructionists, because if we were to block the use of dispersants, or if we were to try to block the tankers and the oil flow, the oil industry would say, well, we could have cleaned this up, except what? The fishing industry kept us from using the dispersants. Let's let them hang themselves. And the problem that we have to address now is a lot of this oil has turned into a moose. Now, after all this, and after these guys are out here tomorrow, I haven't discussed this yet, but I have a talk that I can distribute in paper form, but it's on the effects of the fate and effects of oil in the marine environment, and I want people in here to be able to get copies of this and read it. But the oil forms a mousse, okay? It's no longer dispersible. It's no longer... Chemical dispersants don't work once the mousse is formed. What we need is to figure out how we're going to clean this oil up off the beaches. That's the thing we're going to have to concentrate on now, is what kind of efforts and what kind of resources it's going to take to clean up our oil beaches. Let's not be obstructionists. Let's let these guys tie their own, hang from their own noose, okay?
I would like to suspend this discussion at this time. We stopped the flow of traffic earlier because I was under the impression that some of our key participants had to leave rather suddenly. Since that is no longer the case, I would like to continue with the parties on my left-hand side that have not yet had a chance to address this crowd over here and let them say a few words as well. So, I think it's...
I'm sorry to interrupt, and I just have a couple of comments. I've been over in Valdez, kind of in the thick of things over there. That's where we're doing the real battle here tonight, but it leads us back to the battle over there. And if I could just respectfully make just a few comments, and then I would love to see it go as you would like to do it. Is that okay?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to read from them a little bit, but they're coming from my heart. We're all humans here, and humans make mistakes. We need to learn from our mistakes, and we need to heal. The people who are up on the stage are just like you and I. I think we're all responsible for this oil spill. Most of us here in Cordova have known for years or been afraid that it would happen. And I know I haven't done all that I could have done to prevent this accident. We say the pipeline helps our national security. I would say that this oil spill we just dumped on ourselves, the largest oil spill in North American history, in the finest marine area in North America, did more damage to the U.S. than anything the Russians do to us. We need to heal. The pipeline should never have come into Prince William Sound. We all need oil in this world. There's no denying that's the situation, okay? We all use it. But we can't risk our world to get it. We need to change the way we do business. Our fishermen are out there right now while we're all talking here, doing the work for us, okay? And they're not doing it for money. They're doing it because this is their home. And you can't pay money for people to protect their home. You know, I understand you people at Exxon want to give us money. I know in your hearts you believe that's the right thing to do, to make financial reparation to us. But those fishermen out there tonight are not doing it because you're going to pay them. They're doing it because they have to do it, okay? We will need money for our efforts. You know, our pockets aren't as deep as your pockets are, okay? We're going to need money for our efforts out there. But our efforts are not to make money. We do it because we love the world here. Okay, now I'm getting down to the real business of my talk. We have lots of problems and we need to heal. And we need to get real for a moment. This is not yet our worst nightmare. And we need to suspend our grievances for a little while and finish our work. We have a tanker out there that still has four times the oil in it than what we've already lost. Okay? That's a very serious situation. We can't afford to let that oil into Prince William Sound. All right? The thing we would all like to see is what Exxon is trying to do, and I can assure you from having been over in Valdez, it's their number one commitment, is to get that oil peacefully out of that tanker and onto other tankers. That's the best single thing that any of us could wish for at this moment, okay? Is for that oil to get off that tanker and onto other tankers. And it seems to be happening that way. It's a slow, careful process. And if the weather and everything holds with us, if things remain peaceful, that can probably happen. This is also Prince William Sound, Alaska. We've already had 60 knot winds out there. 2 days from now, we could have 100 knot winds out there. And again, the world could tell us you're just human beings and it could take over for us. So we have to plan, we have to have a contingency plan for that tanker out there. We can't, I believe we can't afford to let that oil go into Prince William Sound. So hopefully we can peacefully offload it. If that becomes untenable, I think we have to consider burning the tanker or whatever. We just have to figure some worst case scenario to get rid of that oil where it is and not let it into Prince William Sound. And that probably would mean evacuating the native village of Tetitlik. I think this is the real work, and this is probably what we need to decide tonight and have in our minds, is how to make sure the oil that's in that tanker doesn't get into Prince William Sound. And I'd love to see it go peacefully under your tankers. And so thank you. That's what I wanted to say.
Thank you, Dave. I have the Department of Environmental Conservation here, represented by two individuals who are going to make a very brief statement. They assure me it'll be very brief, and then we'll go on to Dan Warren from PISWAC, who will talk about the impact of this oil spill on the hatcheries.
Hi, my name is Colleen Berg. I'm an environmental field officer with the Department of Environmental Conservation. Actually, I'm really not making a statement at all, so I know you have more questions, and I want to hear those questions as well. I do want to primarily just pass along greetings from our commissioner, Denny Kelso, and also express his regrets for not being here. He was aware of this meeting about the same time I was, which was when I got into Valdez Saturday morning. He had every intention of coming. You may be aware that we've got some cabinet members in Valdez, the governor, and he got pretty committed to some meetings and some flyovers with that group, and so he was pretty committed and couldn't be here. I just want to assure you that I'm his eyes and ears here tonight. I'm taking all your comments and questions back with me to the commissioner, and like he said in his press conference earlier today, we're making every effort in the department to do a variety of things, everywhere from maintaining a watch on the vessel, monitoring the vessel, doing our scientific monitoring impact assessment work with one group in our department, also working with contractors on containment and cleanup measures. And here is where we've had a tremendous amount of support, which has already been mentioned, from the commercial fishermen. They're in our office, their phones are our phones, and we're working with them. It's going well, and we appreciate every effort that they're making. That's basically all I wanted to say. I do also want to mention that Manny Soares is here, conservation manager, supervisor for our seafood inspection program. That's the other side of this story that DEC is gearing up for, and that is an aggressive approach to product inspection and doing everything we can do while we're cleaning up the mess and supervising cleanup. We're gearing up the other part of our department to make sure that any product taken out of this area is a quality product and that the industry maintains its quality. That's all I have. Thank you. Thank you. Dan Warren from PISWAC.
My name's Dan Warren. I'm the Vice President of the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association. Much of the information in this prepared statement is very familiar to our area, Prince William Sound fishermen, but I would like to use this as a little bit of a forum to educate visitors and any members of the press on the fact that we do have a world-class aquaculture program here that was started by fishermen in this community. The Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation is a regional nonprofit salmon enhancement association for the Prince William Sound area and operates one of the largest salmon enhancement programs in the world. PISWAC is currently the largest producer of hatchery salmon in Prince William Sound. The state of Alaska and Valdez Fisheries Development Association also produce large numbers of hatchery salmon and contribute significantly to the commercial fisheries in the sound. The total hatchery program currently contributes approximately $50 million annually to the area commercial fisheries and is of vital importance to the region's economy. There's a total of five hatcheries in the sound, three operated by Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation, one by Valdez Fisheries Development Association, and one by the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The Valdez Fisheries Development Hatchery is located at Solomon Gulch in Port Valdez and produces mostly pink salmon, some chum salmon. The state hatchery is located at Main Bay and has recently switched to producing sockeye salmon. The three Prince William Sound aquaculture hatcheries are located at Canary Creek, in Unaquik Inlet, Esther Island at the south end of the Coggill District, and Port San Juan in Sawmill Bay, or Armin F. Cornick Hatchery in Sawmill Bay in the western southwestern corner of the sound. Canary Creek and AFK Hatchery produce pink salmon, and Esther Island produces mostly pinks, chums, coho, and chinook salmon. Esther Island AFK hatcheries have been identified as sensitive areas by the oil spill group, as has the state's Main Bay hatchery. A total of approximately 675 million juvenile salmon, this includes salmon out of the Gulfana hatchery on the Upper Copper River, are beginning out-migration from incubators into saltwater rearing pens at hatchery facilities. These fish must be fed and released into nearshore areas between mid-April and mid-June. FISWAC believes that the oil spill from the Axon Valdez will impose a threat to these fish. The AFK hatchery at Port San Juan will release approximately 172 million juvenile pink salmon this spring. Esther Island will release 162 million pink salmon, 91 million chum salmon, 2.5 million coho, 200,000 chinook, and 2.7 million sockeye salmon fry. The Canary Creek hatchery will release approximately 60 million pink salmon fry at the Canary Creek site. Main Bay hatchery is producing 4.5 million sockeye, and the Valdez Fisheries Development will be releasing upwards of 137 million pinks, 3 million chums, and a million coho. The majority of the pink salmon harvest in 1989 is expected to be hatchery produced. Approximately 30 million adult salmon are expected to return to hatcheries in Prince William Sound in 1989. A minimum of 70% of these will be harvested by commercial and sport fishermen in the common property fishery, contributing millions of dollars to fishermen, processors, local communities, outside communities, and dollars back to the state of Alaska. We are very concerned about the effects of this oil spill on the fish themselves and the potential effects of hysteria or on the marketing of these fish and problems with product problems with those fish related to the oil. As far as what we've done for our hatcheries, we have mobilized oil containment booms to protect the juvenile salmon that are currently going out into rearing pens, and we are mobilizing enough boom to actually go across bays, especially at Esther and the Port San Juan facility. We are also pursuing an aggressive program to assure that all concerns we have are answered on the potential effects to juvenile and adult salmon. We have added staff necessary to help with in coordinating information that we need that is being collected by all agencies involved and possibly help in any way we can in getting information for all our specific concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. I understand there are still one or two more prepared statements in the audience that may like to be aired. Is the Chamber of Commerce? Come up to the center aisle and grab a microphone.
I have a question that I'd like to direct towards Exxon. Thank you. My question, there's been a lot of talk about the fishermen and the economy that they're based on. There's not been a lot of talk about the local businesses and the economies that this community rely on. Myself and my wife, we run a small business on Main Street, and we'd like to know what kind of assurances that you're going to give us that is going to assure our future to even maintain a business on Main Street down in Cordova for the future to come and for this year as it stands.
Well, I really don't know what to give you in the way of an assurance for the future. There are an awful lot of things that happen to businesses besides what would flow from this oil spill. But if you can show that you have a loss as a result of this spill, we will compensate it.
Now, in my mind, I find it very difficult to be able to go to you with a reasonable claim that we supposedly lost or did not make a potential dollar value at the end of the season. I just don't see the legitimacy of that being handled with your lawyers. I just find it very difficult to find that there will be any beneficial value given towards the local businesses in this community. Along those lines, it just seems utterly impossible in my mind to be able to show that. I'm sure that if we made X amount of dollars last year and didn't quite make it this year, that may be something. But like you say, there are a lot of factors involved. And I personally believe that this oil spill is going to be a devastating factor for the economy of this community outside of the normal fisherman who has a permit and a boat and goes out and makes his living and then leaves for the winter months and leave, you know, basically we're the ones that are here for the winter, for the summers, and all year round, trying to maintain our livelihoods and our lifestyles here. Right now, the city of Valdez is experiencing an economic boom due to the oil spill. The hotels are full, the cars are rented, the standing line only in the restaurants. You know, it's like Cordova's being kicked one more time. You know, I would like to see more representation of your companies and the other affiliates here in Cordova on a regular basis to keep us informed on what's going on rather than us having to try to gain this information through one or two meetings or possibly picking up what we can on the radio. It seems that we've really been left out of this whole process, and we'd really appreciate being more involved in what's going on. Thank you.
Did you want a response to that? Because what I can tell you is I can give you an example of a very simple claim to settle, and I can give you an example of a claim that we would haggle over for a long time. But what you have to realize is the fuzzier the claim is, the more difficult it's going to be to settle. If you can show that you had a loss and you can tie it to this spill reasonably, it'll get very serious consideration. I assure you of that. But if you come in with something, you know, like Ed McMahon didn't call you because of this bill, that we'll argue over that a long time. I don't mean to be facetious, but if you give me a case that's really fuzzy, it'll be hard to show. Go ahead.
What more do we have to show? This wing sound was beautiful a week ago, and now it's bullshit. Yeah!
That's not what we were talking about.
Right. I'm afraid, Michelle, you're behind. Steve Renberg was before you, and so is Dewey.
I can address this issue right now. If I address this issue. Okay.
My name is Steve Renberg. I'm Vice President of the Chamber of Cordova Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber represents over 100 business interests in Cordova, all of whom earn a substantial part of their revenues, either directly or indirectly, from commercial fishing. Cordova is presently in its infancy in diversification of its economy. But even if Cordova were now to have a diversified economy, the extent and nature of that diversification would be largely determined by the fisheries resources within the Prince William Sound. The livelihoods of over 2,500 Cordovan citizens are directly impacted by the commercial fishery activities in the Prince William Sound. The oil spill disaster that has occurred in the Sound could have serious immediate and long-term negative effects on the economy and well-being of Cordova. The Chamber asks that federal, state, and oil industry officials give credence and due concern to the needs of the business community and local governments in Prince William Sound, such as Cordova, which risks substantial economic damage if the fishing industry is seriously impacted by the oil spill disaster. To this end, the Chamber requests that the commission be established with representatives from all the Prince William Sound communities impacted by the oil spill for the purpose of determining and assessing the immediate and long-term economic impacts of a disaster of this magnitude. Thank you.
I don't have a statement or a question. I guess maybe it's a suggestion to DEC if you are the folks that approve the contingency plans for Alyeska, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, well, that's not good enough. What I would suggest is quarterly on-site inspections of all gear and personnel and regular emergency exercises conducted to your satisfaction. And maybe that would do a little bit better than just approval of a paper contingency plan. And that's all I had.
Okay. Just real quickly, I used to review contingency plans in the southeast region. I don't do them up here. I have the Alyeska plan. We do approve them. The approvals are usually good for 3 years. They are required under state law. Believe me, we are looking at this plan review again. There are tests that are required, exercises that we require of the companies with approvals. Your suggestion, I'm taking it back with me. Thank you. Michelle? George Nelson wishes to respond as well.
Yes, I heard your last suggestion, and that is what the program has been for years. There are frequent inspections, the unannounced inspections. There are frequent drills of different kinds, different scenarios, and that kind of thing. So there has been a lot of what you're suggesting, sir, that has been done on an ongoing basis. And there is, my understanding, a staff in the ADC that particularly works on oil spill plans, I believe, contingency plans, that does do that. So there has been a great deal of that. I just wanted to let you know.
Thank you. Michelle, go ahead now. I'd like to address this to Mr. Cornett. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but last year here in Prince William Sound, we received more money for one red salmon than you did for one of your barrels of oil. And I'm just curious to if it has crossed your mind whether or not that will be the case next year. That's the first part of my question. The next part is that I have a feeling that we as the fishermen in the community here are guilty until we're proven innocent of the value of our lives and our livelihood here in Prince William Sound. Whereas I feel that you are innocent until proven guilty as you continue to reap large profits while we continue to suffer. Will you pay us for the disruption to our lives and to our livelihood while you're busy figuring out what our losses really are with yourself and your committees? You need to figure out how to help us without placing the burden of proof on us. It was your mistake. Both personally, financially, and most of all, the heart of our lives here in Cordova is our environment, have been tremendous and they're irreplaceable. We don't want to spend our time in your claims office arguing over our right to the value of our lives when we would much rather be out in Prince William Sound doing whatever we can to clean up our beautiful, pristine and environmentally rich environment. Thank you, Michelle.
I would like to respond to this.
Go ahead.
have to understand that if I come up here and try to relate to your lifestyle and make comments on it, I'm going to look stupid. My purpose is to give you hard facts as I understand them from the inside of Exxon. And I have talked today to the president of the company 3 times. Come to this site. I really am a resource for you, that's all. And if I give you answers you don't want to hear, you better recognize them as the truth, because I'm not here to salve you. I know what I'm talking about. I know my business. And I'm not going to get in a yelling match with you about your lifestyle. And if I come in and even comment on your lifestyle, I look corny. So I'm just not going to do that. I'm going to tell you what Exxon is prepared to do. Sure, you think you feel bad about this. We feel awful about it. But that doesn't help to come tell you that. I'm here to tell you what we're going to do about it. And I'm going to show you what we're doing about it. And we're doing the best job that's ever been done on an oil spill. And watch, just watch. And then if you have a loss, bring it to us. Now, you want to come in today and have me hand you some money? What have you lost at this point?
Late and a little bit lax. Well, I think that if we look into it, we'll find that there's a lot more boom there than that one plane load, and besides, it was 2 plane loads.
But I'll find out. I don't know. I wish I knew. That's as straight as I've got.
Write it down.
Go ahead, Taya. Well, it seems rather obvious to me that the technology and the equipment is not available for a spill of this size. What's the probability of having an upper limit to the amount of oil that can be transported on any one vessel at any one time?
What's the probability of limiting the size of tankers? Well, I think that genie is about out of the bottle already, because they're already up to 500,000 deadweight ton tankers in the world. They don't come in here. But that's about as big a tanker as you'll see in here.
What I'm saying is, why is there not a lower limit and limiting the amount of oil that...
Once again, we have been reconnected to the town meeting conference going on in Cordova. Hopefully the line situation has stabilized and we'll have no more unexpected interruptions. Again, this is a town meeting in Cordova where members of the community and fishermen are grilling a representative of Exxon and Alyeska over the impact of the Exxon Valdez grounding and oil spill. Coming up, a continuation of the conference from Cordova.
How soon are you talking about pumping money into this community? Are you talking 2 weeks, or do we have to go through a six-month process? Because frankly, sir, 6 months from now, we're all going to be down the tube.
I understand that. Well, let me deal with this gentleman's question first. The key to compensation for the loss of the herring fishery is whether it comes off or not, or whether the catch is wholesome or not. That is what you have to know, and then the compensation, I think, would be very prompt. If you can explain a situation that we can understand, we have the resources to respond to it. So don't assume going in that we can't understand what you're saying, or that we don't feel or want to help you. We do.
Okay, I understand what you're saying is that if our fishery doesn't come off and there are people who are involved in that fishery who would have expected to make some money, you're willing to pay them some contribution or retribution, at least some primary payment, virtually immediately. The fish buyers pay cash the day they dump off the fish. Are you willing to respond that quick?
As soon as we know that the herring fishery is not going to take place, we will start compensating people. That's my perception of the commitment that Exxon has made.
Thank you, sir.
Go ahead, Ken.
I have something I think you might be able to understand. I find it inconceivable that a person who has been denied a driver's license in New York and New Hampshire should be able to pilot a 900-foot tanker loaded with enough crude oil to destroy our livelihoods here through very difficult waters. Is there going to be a change of policy in hiring people on those tankers in the future?
Exxon's policy on hiring people on their tankers is very much the same as hiring people to go into the production department of the refinery. We go to the colleges that produce the maritime academies, and we hire the best students, and we keep the best performers of those students. The captain that you're referring to, we hired him out of the maritime academy. He's been with us for 20 years. I don't know anything about his record. You've told me something I don't even know. But
why not?
Look. Give me a chance here. I don't even work in the same department as this gentleman. I have never met him in my life. There are people that know tonight everything there is to know about the captain. That will all come out. If that indicates that Exxon has a flaw in its policies, you better believe the policy will be changed. But you can't do something about something you don't know something about. We have to know whether Exxon had knowledge of the man's problem. Yeah, everybody knows everything now. The rumors are all over the place. You can read the New York Times. I mean, the man's wife is sitting home with his house surrounded by TV trucks. There's not a fact in the world we don't know. But that all came out after this collision. So if we missed something somewhere and there was a way of finding that, those policies would be changed, you bet. I think that's what your question was.
This was in the paper today, the Anchorage Daily News, this morning's issue, and I'll read what it says here, the second paragraph. The most recent revocation of the captain's driving license of automobiles was still in effect when the Valdez, under his command, ran aground to 11 million gallons. Where was the first and second mate when the third mate was running the boat? Why was he put in charge of that precarious part of the journey?
I don't know that. That will all come out in the NTSB investigation that's going to be completed next week, I understand. We will all learn this at the same time. I just don't have that information.
I believe Patty is waiting with a question.
I have enough questions for coffee for a week, but I wanted to ask about my major concern. I agree with David Grimes, is getting the tanker off the rock. That's one of them. You say after all the pumps are in operation that you can pump 12,000 barrels an hour, is that correct?
An hour. Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, when will those be in operation and how long will it take to get the oil
okay.
off?
We expect to have all the oil off the ship by Saturday night. And we expect to start to refloat the ship. We're going to seal the deck, and we've discovered there's a lot more buoyancy in the starboard side than we thought. And we think she'll float within 3 or 4 days after that.
My other question is, the weather's very unpredictable here in the spring. What's the worst scenario of the probability of that ship breaking up in a storm?
I think if a real bad storm hits out there, it's very iffy. That the ship is sitting about 30 feet at the bottom, is sitting on that pinnacle, and it's sticking out several hundred feet in the other direction. When the wind came up the other night, it rotated about 12 degrees. It's a very precarious position. That's why getting that oil off there, I mean, there's enough oil on there to create a spill four times as big as we've had. That is the most touchy part of it. So we are approaching it very gingerly, but as fast as we can.
Thank you.
We're shipping in increased diameter, larger diameter pipes, and putting all the pumps on there that we can effectively use. You must realize, as you take the oil off, you change the stresses in the hull of the ship, you have to put water back in to keep the stresses the same so that you don't buckle it or cause it to shift or roll. Ship salvage is a very specialized business. It requires people that know. You could have the pumps and not have the expertise there, and it wouldn't do you any good. Ship salvage is something that's done around the world by experts, and when you get into a situation like this, you bring those people in that know what they're doing. Don't send somebody out there with pumps that doesn't know what he's doing.
That wasn't the answer for that back 6 years ago when Congress and Washington and our federal boys and you guys came and talked to us, said you would be prepared for me. So.
We have had...
We
were prepared for a major spill.
Well, this is what I'm saying. I guess the crux of the question boils down to, from this point in time, how long will it be before that tanker is emptied? Is it going to be 36 hours, 48 hours, 6 weeks?
About Saturday night it'll be emptied. And then if something happens to it, there's not enough oil in it to worry about a slick, but then you've got a hulk to get rid of. About Saturday night it'll be emptied. And then if something happens to it, there's not enough oil in it to worry about a slick, but then you've got a hulk to get rid of if it doesn't sink. But we're hoping.
Well, we're not trying to pick your bones clean. You've already been kicked enough. We just want some answers, sir. Please try to understand that.
Who's talking? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I understand that, and I have some answers that are better than others. I'm doing the best I can. But I'm trying to be honest with you. I'm sorry if it doesn't fit what you hope.
Okay, let's go to the next question.
I want to ask Mr. Zimmerman a question there. Why is it that there's so much publicity on the sea lion and sea otter act on the flats? You're going to shut us down for fishing on the flats because we kill a couple sea otters in our gill nets, and the sea lions are a big pain in the butt. And yet this oil slick could kill everything in Prince William Sound, and we don't hear anything about that.
Well, unfortunately, I don't control how the publicity aspect of that works. And the best example I can think of is that whale thing, which we felt there was no reason to rescue those whales, and they got rescued anyway. As far as your question, if I understood it, there was a compromise made so that fishing could occur this year. And part of that compromise was that no more than 1,350 sea lions would be killed. That was part of a compromise to allow fishing to go forward. And in that regard, we have to keep track of that, and I guess if more than that number are taken, or if there's an allocated way of doing it, and the allocated number is more than that's taken, we'll have to reorient fisheries. Congress told us to do that. We don't have any control over that.
So what's going to happen if this spill kills 1,350 sea lions?
Well, there won't be 1,350 left for you to kill, so you can fish all you want, I guess. The point is this, however, and I don't mean to be... This number of sea lions that's being, if there are any killed by the oil spill, it won't count against your quota.
Well, what I don't understand, you're going to put 30% observers on our fishing boats to monitor so we don't harm these critters, yet I don't see one person, they don't care if the oil industry kills any of these animals.
Well, there's not much we can do about it at this point. I mean, if it kills, the sea lion's too big.
What about penalties?
That's just like the Coast Guard. Last year, I couldn't go herring seine because I didn't have a book on rules of the road. And yet, 16 of these tankers can have big stress cracks in them to go clear to San Diego. You know, these little tiny laws, you pick on the little guy. left up.
You're probably right. And I don't know what to do about that particular scenario. The oil's going to maybe kill some sea lions or maybe not, and the world's going to be real worried about them. You guys have a limit on what you can kill. That's a different matter, and it's based on what Congress enacted. And I'm sorry, I can't figure any solution to that particular problem.
Next question.
This question is directed towards Mr. Connett. It's more of a suggestion, I guess, at this point. I am very much concerned with the environment and the fisheries, but I'm also concerned with the local economy here, and I really think that you should start to consider operating out of Cordova on this cleanup. We've got a large airport out here. We don't have the weather problem that Valdez does. We've got plenty of capacity here to handle some of this boom material and distribution of it. The boats, the fishing vessels that are doing the work now are doing it out of, are based in Cordova. It'd be just as easy for them to come here and pick up this material and go out as it would to go to Valdez. It's probably just as far away from here as it is from Valdez. And this would probably help to, you know, help some of the economy that we're suffering right now. I'm sure that this would stimulate something, anything at this point would be helpful.
I'll pass that suggestion to the operating people when I get back.
I have a question, really short. Actually, the point that I called you on earlier was, I know there are people in this audience who are much more knowledgeable about, perhaps the woman from Greenpeace and behind me right here. I keep hearing about all the non-compliance that has gone on down the years to the standards that were set for the operations of companies like Exxon, and very much so also for the terminal. And my suspicion is, now I was kind of going to turn your style back on yourself. I don't mean that as put down, but at all. If you can give us a reason for those compliances, and if you need a specific one, I'm sure someone else can bring one up. But a good reason for the non-compliance. My suspicion is that it will always come down to dollar and cent. And so my question is, how much did you save? And my question for myself and yourself and the entire world is, regardless of how much you saved, how much is that worth?
Well, you're implying that this spill resulted from some non-compliance.
Forget this spill. I'm asking about the non-compliance I've heard about.
With what? Is the question the lady behind you asked earlier?
Okay, let me address this to Alyeska. Why are there only 18 of these tanks?
Well, can you hear me back there?
Yeah, who's rubber stamping you guys through sane, reasonable standards?
Nobody is rubber stamping us, and in regard to the other issues, we do believe we are in compliance, and we are prepared to approve that. I did not understand that kind of stuff was the subject for today's meeting, tonight's meeting, I should say, but however, if the people in Cordova would like to talk about that, either myself or others would be prepared to come back at a later date and talk about that. We have tried to get in contact with the people in Cordova and would like to explain the situation on some of these things that have been stated. And so, like I say, we're prepared to do that at a later date.
It may be the DEC, you know, I don't know. I read this article about the tankers and the condition of the tankers and the appalling figures of penalties that were levied. I understand that, if you levy fines and penalties against a company with the power of Exxon, you know, you're going to get a battery of lawyers. You can see there's a financial problem there. Now, what can we do? I read in that article that the fine had a limit on it unless there was gross negligence of $63 per barrel of oil. And I kind of penciled that out, and I don't remember the figure that I came up with, but it's paltry compared to, even if you add it up for all the barrels that are out there in the sound right now, it's a paltry sum of money.
What? I'm not sure I understand what your question is.
It may not be directed at you. What I'm saying is that I've heard that there was supposed to be, in the original highest quality standard design of the facility there, that there should be more storage tanks. And we would not be in such a pinch to rely on a tanker fleet that has at least 16 suspicious marginal craft in it. You know, I understand from this article that the DEC gives certain approvals and, you know, slaps hands and assesses fines or not. The largest fine mentioned in that article was $1,000.
Well, I cannot comment on the fines. I simply, you know, who's been fined for what kind of thing.
Does the DEC have anything to say about that?
Well, personally, I'd love to answer that question. I have varied my position in the Anchorage office is only just a small part of the operations at the terminal. All the different operations at the terminal are covered by several programs in DEC. This question has come up several times, as has other questions dealing with the operations. So the answers are available. Unfortunately, I'm not the best person to give you those answers. I think part of the information that we need to get out to the public and this audience here, as far as the overall, you know, everything that's involved with this spill, are probably answers on the terminal itself. These are all coming back again. So those answers are available. I need to get to the right people to do that.
Thank you. This is also a question, obviously, for the Coast Guard. Let's have a little, you know, zero tolerance mentality on some of the, you know, gross negligence or wrongdoing for tankers.
This comment about fines, you know, the fine for an oil spill, as you probably know, is from $1, there has to be a fine, from $1 to a maximum of $5,000. That's written in law. The Coast Guard can't change that. Congress can change that.
But my understanding is that the Coast Guard, you know, can't
right.
waive fines. Is that?
Well, we can't waive the fine, but the people can figure out what's an appropriate fine from $1 to $5,000.
Maybe. Well, it's like a traffic cop stopping me, and he can let me go if I'm.
No.
We
can't let you go, but the judge can say, well, you know, half the fine, that type of thing. You have to be fined, but you know, but our office here doesn't say what the fine would be. That gets sent on to another office, you know. An administrative thing. For negligence and things like for operating vessels, obviously, you know, for an individual whose livelihood is based on having a license issued by the Coast Guard, the worst you could do to that individual would be to take the license away. Right?
I would like
drug
to interrupt.
Drug convictions is an automatic loss of the license.
At this point, line of questioning is not really leading us anywhere. Claudia's been waiting a long time with a question, so I'd like to turn it over to Claudia.
I don't have a question. I have a request, and I want to take a break for just a moment from all the questions that reflect how hard we're trying to understand something that seems to be next to impossible to understand. As part of this community and part of a group of people who organize this event, I want to take some time to thank each one of you for coming and being here. And helping us understand, especially all of you that have sat up there so silently. My request is that before you leave, or as you work over the next months and years, that you recognize how excruciating it is for us to sit here and do nothing as a part of the planet that we love so much suffers and dies. And if you would please contact us through CDFU and let us know specifically how we, as members of this community, can help you. And an added note, Mr. Zimmerman, there are many people in this community who care a lot about marine mammals.
And on that nice positive note, I think we're all ready to call this a day. Unless there are some overwhelming questions that need to be answered, I think we've all put a lot of effort into this, a lot of energy, and I know there are more questions. I think we need to coordinate and get all those questions put together and then address them to the appropriate agency, and I am certain that we will get answers. But we'll give you one last swan song there, Jerry.
Okay, I heard rumors from different people that flew over the tanker, and they said it looked like there was oil on the deck and down the side. I was wondering, was there, or did they pump some oil overboard, or are these just rumors?
To clarify your question, oil on the side of the tanker now, or oil on the tanker?
No, when they heard that the oil tanker was on the rock, apparently a few pilots went out and looked at it, and I was rumored that there was oil on deck and over the side, and I was wondering...
That's right, there was. Because, and I'm not positive about the action. I wasn't there on the scene. My investigators were telling me what they saw when they got there. Apparently the force of the impact created enough water outside and the load of the oil inside, enough pressure that some of the ullage openings blew out and oil shot up, and then, you know, obviously fell on deck and came down the side.
I have one last question for Mr. Cornett, if I could. Mr. Cornett, since you appear to have the greatest longevity up there and probably the biggest historical memory, do you think in light of this event, you would have reconsidered the Canadian route? The pipeline through Canada that the fishermen brought lawsuit to try to impose on your companies back in 1971?
Sure, I'd reconsider it.
You think it's been worth it?
Oh, this has been a phenomenal success. It's hell to say that today, but this has been one of the greatest successes and one of the largest projects we've ever been involved with. But I would reconsider it. I mean, I would have to look at the project and see. But, yeah, I would reconsider it.
That's too bad it didn't get a little more consideration then. We wouldn't be sitting here tonight.
Pipelines have bad spills also, unfortunately, but they do.
Your fingers waving?
Yeah, I'd like to ask just one more question. Is there a possibility that the Exxon people would be interested in building a permanent facility in Cordova for these kind of cleanups in case it happened, just so it would be available here?
Well, I think that would be something that, all the different owners, we're only a 20% owner of that facility, all the owners would need to do that. I think that, as a result of this, certainly the owners' committee is going to review that situation also, and I don't know what they will do, but I'm sure they will be very, their awareness will be very heightened by this incident. No question about it.
Okay, thanks.
Claudia has one last comment to wrap this whole thing up. Excuse me, the janitorial staff has gone home, and we could use as much help as people want to give cleaning this place up so there can be school tomorrow. So if you're so inclined, please help.
We have to sign off. Thank you.
And so at long last, the town meeting in Cordova, with representatives from Alyeska, George Nelson, president of Alyeska, Don Cornett from Exxon, and members of various regulatory agencies, is now concluded. We will be bringing you many more live events tomorrow as they occur, and stay tuned to KCHU. Each hour on the hour, we'll try to update what we anticipate for the day's schedule, keeping in mind that changes are frequent and posted times are rarely exactly adhered to. I want to thank the University of Alaska and the Legislative Teleconference Bridge Teleconferencing Network. All those stations down the line, thank you for bearing with us through our technical difficulties, and to our listeners, thank you for bearing with us as well. I'm Dave Hammack, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.